The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report, sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. During his first overseas trip, President Biden joined other NATO leaders to make cyber a key alliance priority, as well as designating a cyber attack on one member as possible sufficient grounds to trigger the Atlantic Alliance's Article 5 mutual defense clause. Joining us today to talk about the move, as well as how the alliance and its members can improve cybersecurity as well as deterrence, are Dr. Erica Borgard, Senior Cyberspace Solarium Commission Director, as well as a Senior Fellow at the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Martin Howard, a retired British Senior Security Official who served at the Ministry of Defense at NATO, as well as the Cyber Director of GCHQ, the UK equivalent of the National Security Agency. He's currently the Senior Team Leader for NATO and Cyber at Universal Defense and Security Solutions, a fascinating consultancy in the UK. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks very much.
And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. Erica, start us off. This is a step that the alliance has been moving toward for some time. It still includes a lot of caveats, right? NATO leaders have made clear that any response to a cyber attack would be made on a case-by-case basis, depending on damage, attribution, and other factors that are somewhat less of a concern if it had been sort of an out-and-out kinetic attack, as we would have seen when Article 5 was first crafted. And their leaders effectively did what they always do, which is give themselves wiggle room, but it's still a very, very important step. So what's your take on the statement that a significant malicious and cumulative cyber activity might be cause for invoking Article 5? And is this the kind of statement that is going to have the deterrent effect that leaders hope it will in the wake of a whole series of Russian, Chinese, and other intrusions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I hate to be the pessimist here, but I think that unfortunately, this strikes me as something of a weak statement from a deterrence perspective. If you look at the language of the statement, it's so caveated, right? Cumulative cyber activities might, in some circumstances, be considered as amounting to an armed attack, which could trigger the invocation of Article 5. And I think the problem here is that, you know, as we all know, what's central for deterrence is the perception of the adversary whose behavior you're trying to shape. And so I think we have to ask ourselves the question, how will this kind of statement affect adversaries' perception of the likelihood of Article 5 being sort of meaningfully applied to cyber operations? And I'm just concerned that all of the caveats and the might in some circumstances almost water down whatever sort of implicit deterrence already exists in the context of cyberspace. Because I think making, the kind of sort of caveated statement reveals some of the challenges in arriving at consensus among NATO member states. And I think that in itself could make deterrence weaker rather than stronger. As you alluded to, when a cyber attack would cause an invocation of Article 5 would be done on a case-by-case basis. That makes sense. That would be probably the case in any other domain. The question is, what are the criteria in cyberspace for that would inform decision-making around those cases? And I think more transparency and clarity about what those criteria are would be something that would contribute to strengthening deterrence more. Because saying it will be on a case-by-case basis, I think doesn't quite tell us much. To me, what really stood out was this idea of the accumulation of smaller cyber incidents.
Right.
And I think that that's, on the one hand, I think that's good because I think it reflects an evolution in thinking about you know, how we think about the strategic significance of cyberspace. There was a lot, you know, a couple of years ago, a decade ago, you know, the talk was all about a strategic cyber attack, a cyber Pearl Harbor, a cyber 9/11. And we're coming to recognize that that's not actually what malicious behavior looks like in cyberspace. It looks like this kind of death by a thousand cuts behavior. So I think that's good, that kind of framing of it. But then again, it raises this question of, okay, what is that threshold? And if we can't define it, then I'm not sure how it can serve deterrent purposes, because how will the adversary know when they've crossed it?
Right.
And so it can't be after the fact, because that's not deterrence anymore. So I think there are good things about the statement. I appreciate the inclusion of the kind of accumulation concept rather than the decisive strategic cyber attack. But I'm concerned that there's sort of a lot of weak tea in there.
Martin, let me go to you, right? You served as the cyber director for GCHQ, one of the world's premier signals intelligence organizations on the planet. And there's this dividing line and balance, as you and I have discussed, right, about what is a legitimate intelligence operation and what is causes belli, right? In the wake of SolarWinds or OPM, people were like, you know, this is an act of war. And actually, it was some of the most experienced intelligence leaders in the country who said, hey, not so fast. This was just good intelligence that caught us with our pants down. What does effective deterrence look like for NATO, given the alliance is only as good as the capabilities of its member states?
Yeah. Well, again, that's another great question. And I'll start by saying that I recognize a lot of what Erica has said. And I thought the point about cumulative attacks was actually quite telling. And in a sense, that takes you really into the field of deterrence when you're talking about cyber. I mean, the comparison with deterrence against an armed attack or a nuclear attack is that has a kind of absolute flavor to it. If you're attacked by armed forces or indeed by a nuclear weapon, that is pretty absolute. And being able to deter that is a kind of absolute process. We know the British government has had submarines at sea with nuclear weapons ready to deter that for decades now. I think with cyber, it is different. Both the threat is different. For a start, it's persistent. It's not just one event, it's lots of events, which could accumulate in the way that the statement suggests. And in some ways, the response that NATO, and indeed individual nations, because as you say, NATO is the sum of its individual nations, you know, also has to be a bit less absolute than in the traditional sense of deterrence. And for me, I guess there are two parts to deterrence in the cyber world. There is deterrence in the traditional sense, in the sense that if we NATO or indeed a member state feels that they've been attacked in a very significant way from a cyber threat, then you know there's a possibility of a response. It could be a cyber response. It could be another response. It could be a military response in extreme circumstances. But actually, the other half of deterrence, the thing which might make adversaries sort of think again, is resilience of both of the alliance and its member states. If you make NATO and you make its member states a hard target, a more expensive target, and you get less bangs for your buck, or ruble perhaps in this case, that makes it sort of a less attractive option. If that's right, backed up by a sense in Moscow in particular, possibly in Beijing as well, that NATO and or its member states could also respond and do damage to them, then you can get a kind of deterrence effect. But it's very much a kind of a continuing thing. It's not as absolute, it's not as black and white as deterrence was defined in the Cold War.
Erica, and I want to get both of your guys' senses on this, right? As we record this, President Biden and Vladimir Putin are meeting to address everything from Moscow's aggressive cyber operations, election meddling, destabilizing disinformation, Ukraine, and what have you. But Putin has been remarkably undeterred, unrepentant, and indeed downright comically Soviet in his winkingly untruthful denials. He still maintains, you know, Martin, you were part of the team who, you know, determined that it was two Russian GRU agents that attempted to assassinate Sergei Skripal, costing British lives in the process. And they still maintain those two were tourists who wanted to see the medieval spires of Salisbury Cathedral. At the end of the day, how deterrable are the Russians and the Chinese going to be? And is deterrence actually maybe a flawed concept at this point, going to what Martin said? Is this a question of just ever better defenses at the end of the day, right? I mean, what does it take to deter these great powers that actually have no intention of observing convention or anything else, right? This is a battlefield. We've just been a little bit slow to recognize it for what it is. Go ahead, Erica.
Yeah, so I think it's a great question, and it gets at the heart of some of the things that I think are really, really important when it comes to thinking about how we apply sort of traditional strategic concepts to cyberspace. And, you know, I guess I come at this thinking that there is no actor that is inherently not deterrable. The question is whether we have the right tools and the right leverage and the right credibility from a political perspective to shape their calculus. And I think that the problem when we talk about whether Russia is deterrable or China is deterrable in cyberspace is that we ask these questions from sort of a binary perspective. And I think that getting to sort of more meaningful policymaking, we need to kind of unpack it and ask the question of sort of what exactly are the things that we think we can deter and what are the things we perhaps can't. And therefore, in the context of the things where deterrence might be more of a challenge, which I do think is sort of below that threshold, malicious cyber activity that doesn't rise to a level of armed attack, but still has strategic consequences, then I see resilience as being having the potential for sort of secondary deterrent effects if over time an adversary perceives that we're able to sort of adapt and rapidly recover and respond to malicious cyber incidents rather than let them sort of have meaningful and sustained strategic consequences. But that's kind of a byproduct of resilience efforts. And perhaps we should be thinking about just investing in resilience for its own sake, rather than as a way of trying to sort of shape an adversary's perception. And maybe it will be a happy byproduct of our efforts, but that's not the focus. But I do think that there are areas where we can and should continue to try to shape behavior. And I think particularly at the higher thresholds, we have seen some deterrent successes. There has not been, even though there's been reports about Russian malicious threat actors gaining access to our critical infrastructure, that hasn't led to a follow-on sort of disruptive or destructive attack. And continuing to maintain that threshold is important because we need strategic stability at higher levels. And I think that's exactly where the SolarWinds question, just to bring it back to conversation we were having a few minutes ago, is important because there was a lot of talk about whether this was a foothold for some follow-on attack, but it didn't materialize. And so I think continuing to reinforce deterrence at that high threshold is important and in the US and in NATO interests. But perhaps we should be focusing less on shaping behavior at lower thresholds and more just on simply making ourselves more resilient and, when appropriate, conducting counter cyber operations to degrade adversary offensive capabilities, not necessarily to shape their calculations, but just to make it harder for them to operate and, right, and make ourselves more resilient. So that's my take.
I think it's interesting, right? Martin, you and I yesterday were talking about the Colonial Pipeline and how actually Colonial Pipeline could have been another activity that was masked with the ransomware attack at the end of the day. Talk to us a little bit about your view of the balance as Erica brought in the concept of resilience. For you, it's a balance of resilience, offense, defense. Talk to us about how you do this in a blended and dynamic and persistent manner.
Let me start by echoing what Erica said about, you know, resilience is a good thing per se. It's a full stop. You know, we should be doing it anyway. I mean, one of the limits, the lessons of the pandemic that we've just been through is that. And I think she's quite right to say that its effect on deterrence is a kind of byproduct of that. It isn't necessarily the reason you build deterrence, you build resilience, but it is one of the benefits. You asked the question, you know, is Putin and China deterrable? I mean, the statement certainly isn't going to deter them, as we discussed earlier, but actions will. And I do think that over time, as you build up better cyber defense and you make the alliance, both its own systems and also the systems of its member states, harder to attack and more resilient, that can have a deterrent effect. I think that has to be mixed with an ability to respond in a more direct way. This is tricky territory. I mean, and it's territory which is as yet probably not really very strongly tested in the real world. We first started talking about offensive cyber about 10, 12 years ago. It does raise some very tricky issues around boundaries, about laws, about the legal basis for it. It raises a boundary we've already discussed between aggressive intelligence gathering and disruptive cyber activity. For Putin and others to be deterred in cyberspace, one thing they need to be able to see is that NATO or its member states, so we might come back to what that actually means, can actually take action against them and against those who carried out the attack in the first place, which will be detrimental to them. I think the occasional cyber exercise, the occasional demonstration of intent and some kind of declaratory posture on the use of offensive cyber could well be the right thing to do. Getting it right, though, I think it would be quite a challenge.
I want to pull on that a little bit, Martin. When you look at the threat, does an international convention, as many have been discussing, to try to put rules of the road down? I briefly want to get a sense from both of you. Is that a sensible thing? Because there hasn't been an arms accord that hasn't been violated in some capacity, although some of them have been verifiable and more than somewhat lasting. For example, strategic arms limitation talks. Do you think that it's possible to craft sort of global rules of the road, as the Biden administration would like to do, to try to make at least illegal some of these things that are happening now?
I think that's, again, these are some really good questions. It's not a new question. We did actually talk about this again 10 or 11 years ago. And William Hague, when he was Foreign Secretary, actually at a conference in London, and I think 2011, 2012, actually set out, seven sort of rules of the road as far as the use of cyberspace is concerned. But you can't sort of de-link this from the nature of the internet. All of this happens on the internet, and the internet is not a single entity. Its ownership is extremely distributed. The way it operates is extremely distributed. So coming up with effective rules of the road for operating in cyberspace on the internet is difficult. However, having said that, I do think there is a case of trying. I think there are some aspects of behavior in cyberspace that we should at least try and discuss, both with our allies and our friends, but also with people like the Russians and the Chinese, because ultimately they may also see it in their interest that this has got some sort of basis in international law. Now, quite what those ultimately will look like, and also how they impact and relate to existing international law about the use of force, for example, I think, very extremely complex questions. But I would say that it's worth the effort, but it's not a waste of time.
Erica?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of different aspects to your question. And I see three. One is the question of the viability of arms control agreements for cyberspace. The other is the role of norms. And then another that's implied, I think, is the development of confidence building measures. And so I think that to tackle the first one, I think establishing formal arms control agreements for cyberspace is probably a bridge too far. I think that it would just the verification and enforcement of those types of agreements would be particularly challenging given sort of the, not just the secretive nature of cyber capabilities, particularly the ones we're concerned about, offensive capabilities, but the sort of operational requirement for secrecy in that what you would have to do to verify compliance would sort of make those capabilities moot, right? Because revealing information about them enables defenders to take action to protect themselves against those capabilities. So I think arms control might be a bridge too far, but that doesn't mean I think that there are no opportunities for better cooperation and consensus. And I think in terms of confidence building measures, I see that as sort of a step short of arms control. And I think that we've already seen some cooperation and sort of positive outcomes in the context of CBMs for cyberspace, because all states, even adversaries, have a shared interest in avoiding unwanted war and escalation. And that's why we saw the United States and Russia able to come to an agreement to apply the Nuclear Risk Reduction Center established during the Cold War, when tensions were even more salient to prevent the risk of nuclear war, to apply that to cyberspace. And it was reported that the United States used the hotline during the 2016 election interference, where President Obama communicated to Vladimir Putin. So I think that even where there is high tension and competition, there are areas where adversaries can agree that there are things that neither wants and is in neither interest. And I think continuing to pursue confidence building measures will be very important. And then when it comes to norms, we just saw the GGE statement come out and where sort of everyone sort of agreed that around a set of norms of behavior for cyberspace. I think though that to make norms meaningful, they have to be enforced, and I think that's where some of the challenge is the gap between what we all say we agree to, and what state practice actually is, and so I think that norms can emerge sort of implicitly as a result of state practice, and they can also emerge as the result of deliberate diplomatic action, right, and agreements. But for the latter case to be meaningful, we have to do something about them when norms are violated.
Well, right. Whether it's humans or nation states, right? You touch the hot stove, it's really, really bad. You don't want to touch the hot stove again. If there's pain, you will be deterred from action. And unfortunately, right, our sanctions regimes and everything else are such that they're not adaptive enough, right? So whether you're Russia or North Korea or anybody else, you adapt to them, especially if you're a big enough actor. And obviously Russia is as big as it gets, and China is, bigger than everybody else is. Martin, in preparing for this session, you raised a really, really good issue, which is that cyber is a national continuum. It stretches from the national to the military, but the vast preponderance of the networks and the ecosystem is actually commercial in nature. How do nations tackle this challenge? Because at a national level, almost every single nation and their industries and their populations, in fact, are not doing nearly as good of a cyber job, especially when it comes to even the rudiments of defense. Again, as we have seen, whether it's through SolarWinds or whether it's an OPM hack or anything else. How do you address this? Because NATO is a military alliance, and yet the national networks are commercial.
Yeah, I think it's a real challenge. It's a challenge nationally. My own experience of working with this is that if you look at the UK's critical national infrastructure, you make the very good point that a lot of it's in commercial hands, a lot of it's in overseas hands. Only a minority is actually in the government's hands. So the extent to which the government can act directly to build resilience is actually quite limited. I mean, the answer has been so far over several years, a process of education and technical support to sort of the owners of those components of the critical national infrastructure that we think are most vulnerable and most important. And that is a continuous process. There's no sort of silver bullet. You can't say, right, if you follow these standards and follow these practices, everything will be fine. But it is an effort that nationally in the UK we have reinforced over the last 10 years, particularly with the establishment of the National Cybersecurity Centre. As far as NATO is concerned, yeah, I think that the problems are kind of magnified. Firstly, because you've got 30 member states. Secondly, there is this kind of rather simplistic view that NATO is a military alliance. But it's a simplistic view which is sometimes pushed very hard politically by some member states, and I won't name names here. But the fact is that always has been not true, because the North Atlantic Council is a highly political entity, deals with political issues. And as far as the issue of critical national infrastructure and civilian assets are concerned, NATO has had a civil emergency planning capacity for decades. It's just that it's tended to be stuck in Cold War thinking around transport links, shipping, so on and so forth. And it does seem to me that one of the practical things that NATO might think about is whether that sort of expertise in civil emergency planning can actually be harnessed in a more towards cybersecurity and cyber defense, not for NATO to provide it for member states, but again, maybe to set some standards for member states to do so. But I don't think you should underestimate the challenge, because not only have you got the military-civilian divide within NATO, you've also got that within each of the member states, and the complexities of each state in this field are going to be different.
Erica?
Yeah, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with Martin's comments. I would say that coming from the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, one of the core questions that we grappled with was how to improve how the government works with the private sector, particularly those parts of our critical national infrastructure that the private sector owns and operates. That got at the heart of our work. And, you know, I think that Martin is exactly right, that the challenge is that, the government doesn't have a monopoly in this area, and at the same time, threat actors are targeting the private sector for strategic purposes. And so that's the sort of key unique aspect of strategic challenges in cyberspace. And so the way we thought about it from the commission's perspective was, on the one hand, thinking broadly about how to improve the cybersecurity of the ecosystem overall, right? And then in particular, how to improve the security and resilience of critical infrastructure, those assets and systems that are essential for our economy, our way of life, and our national security. And there were a range of different recommendations that the commission put forward, some of which were adopted in the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act, particularly the creation of the National Cyber Director and the corresponding office of the National Cyber Director, but also measures to strengthen CISA within DHS, and work toward more of a operational collaboration model with critical infrastructure. So moving beyond information sharing to actually collaborating on analysis and playbook development and contingency planning and defensive campaign planning. And so that's all positive, but from sort of a conceptual standpoint, but actually getting at that implementation and practice, as Martin alluded to, will be particularly challenging. And it's challenging in the United States. I think the NCSC is a great model in the UK. And then kind of rolling that out across say, November states will present even more of a hurdle because of the unique legal and cultural and organizational and capability and capacity characteristics of all of the various NATO members. But I think if we can get toward some consensus around, as Martin said, some shared standards, or even coming to agreement around the idea that moving toward more of a operationally collaborative approach between government and the private sector, especially critical infrastructure, will be important, you know, to sort of have the effect of a rising wave, raising all ships. I messed up that metaphor, but I think you get my intent.
I think we get your drift, no pun intended. Very, very briefly, we have about a minute and a half left, and I want to put this very quickly to the both of you. You know, the focus, obviously, NATO's focus has always been Russia and the Soviet Union and whatever Moscow is up to. But if you look at it, China has been extremely aggressive and actually sold a remarkable amount of equipment, as Huawei has, that is in military service in Europe. Martin, as alliance members always have a tendency of seeing what's happening to their east as opposed to farther east, and what the Chinese may be up to in the sort of destabilizing things they may be doing. NATO obviously coming to grips with the fact that China is a significant challenge. That was one of the successes of this summit. From your standpoint as a NATO alliance, how much of the focus has to be on Moscow? How much of the focus needs to actually be on Beijing? Well, especially as we go into this 5G more connected universe. And Erica, very briefly, want to get your sense on that as well. Go ahead.
Well, I've always felt that, you know, NATO has been about defense of its territory and defense of its allies, of its member states. And if you're looking at the sort of the hard end of the threats which face them, then to me that is primarily Moscow. I'm not suggesting that Beijing is sort of completely off the radar here, but it seems to me that Moscow is probably the priority. I think the challenge, it almost goes back to what we've just been discussing, is the sort of massive effort that Beijing puts into extracting information, both from governments and crucially from commercial entities. A lot of it is espionage. It's industrial espionage. So I think that the Chinese ability to carry out destructive cyber attacks has risen, and that NATO needs to be cognizant of it. But if you had to sort of lay out priorities for me, I think I'd start with Moscow.
Erica?
Yeah, so very briefly, I also agree that in terms of a sort of direct military threat, Russia is the more obvious priority. But I do think that thinking over the long term, there is value in thinking about the role of NATO and sort of strategic reorientation to address China. And it's at the moment, it is a different type of threat. And so I just think it will require the alliance to be more adaptable and a bit more farsighted than it's been. So I think that the challenge will be balancing those sort of potentially competing challenges. But I do think that at the moment, the military threat does continue to come from Russia.
Martin, let me ask you, and if you can give this to me in the 30-second version of it, unfortunately, because we're almost out of time, how to think about what is a legitimate intelligence operation that you should blame yourself for allowing your adversary to get away with? And what is something that falls much more on a causus belli? Because I think that even very senior people have a tendency of conflating those two in their minds about what's legitimate and what is illegitimate.
At one level, it's very simple. If you're conducting espionage, you want to gather intelligence. That could mean quite aggressive cyber intrusions into your target country or entity or organization. The techniques that you use to do that are actually quite similar to the kind of techniques you would need to do to carry out or prepare or be able to carry out a cyber attack. Now that, I think, is the dilemma. But I think the difference is in the intent. If the intent is to gather intelligence, whether we're talking about commercial intelligence, military intelligence, other secret intelligence, then, you know, we've been doing it for years. The Russians have been doing it for years, decades. And we're doing it now in a new environment, not so new now, a newer environment in cyberspace. But if the intent is actually to use that access to an adversary cyberspace to carry out disruptive activity, even destructive activity, then that's the point at which it crosses the line for me.
Guys, thanks so very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Fascinating discussion. Look forward to staying in touch with you both as we continue to peel the many interesting layers of this strategic onion. Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.